I understand y'all.
Thank you, Garland, and thank all of you. It's really a pleasure to be here. I have enjoyed this convention just tremendously. And I think the most of you have. I enjoyed dancing last night. We stayed here and had this party, and it was really good. My name is Lee Atterbury, and I am an alcoholic. I used to say that by practicing these principles and these steps to the best of my ability is the way I stayed sober. I've had to change that. I do not practice these principles or these steps to the best of my ability. I only practice them well enough for me to keep peace of mind, a little serenity, and live an everyday normal life for a recovering alcoholic. So that's the way it is with me today. And I have done this for 18 years, 2 weeks, and 2 days. And I am grateful for that. Without you people, I couldn't have done this at all. But this is something to me that these conventions are, there's always a little extra. We may hear just as good as stories, we may hear just as good as talks at the little meeting, but we don't get the thrill from it. We don't open our eyes, our minds, our hearts, and really get down to the nitty-gritty. And this is what we like from this. We receive it. I think we're all here for the same purpose. It's to have a better tomorrow, you know. And if we listen to these people, we will have a better tomorrow. Now, I'm going to do something my wife told me not to. I am an alcoholic, I don't mind it. You know, she says, leave the storytelling to the people who tell stories well. And I tried to tell jokes, you know, the last time I told a joke from the podium, why nobody ever knew when I reached the punchline. They didn't know anything about it. I'm going to tell this little joke because I liked it anyway. You see, this lady was washing dishes, and I suppose she was Al-Anon, you know. So as she was standing at the sink washing dishes, and her son was sitting at the table, he was presumably doing his homework, you know, sitting there writing, a third grader. And all at once he raised up from what he was doing, and he said, Mama, said, how do you spell Kitty? And then she fumbled them dishes and dropped them and rustled. And finally she got it back together and she said, son, are you doing your homework? He said, no, I'm writing to my little girlfriend. Then she fumbled them dishes again. And he going. So she said, what in the world are you saying to your little girlfriend? She said, he said she wasn't at school yesterday. And I just asked her what she done yesterday. So that's the way in this program, sometimes we misunderstand, you know, really what's going on. We don't get it all together just right. So, but I want to get that little story out before we go. And I don't want to tell you anything about myself. What I want to do is I want to hear this man from Minnesota. I didn't know him until this weekend. I had never met him. I had heard of him. And I had heard the people in Whitney talk about him and wanted to meet him, you thought. So I got to meet him this weekend, and now I'm really looking forward to hearing what he has to say. And I know that I'm going to go away, and the most of y'all are going to leave here today with a little more light on our lives and the way that we will live and the way we conduct ourselves from here out. So right now I will give you Bob Beeve from St. Paul, Minnesota.
Morning, my name is Bob Devines and I'm an alcoholic. It's a pleasure and a privilege to be here with you. I'm going to end up doing what I always do, and that's kind of tell my story. But one of the things I could do to kind of tell my story and to tell what Alcoholics Anonymous is, I could go around this room, and there's probably 50 people in this room who I know only from the fellowship and who I've known for as long as 15 years and for as short as having dinner last night. And many of them have made a profound difference in my life. And I couldn't do that because it takes most of my talk to go around and point that out. But Marceline's here, who I love very much. And she and her husband have touched me greatly. And there are, you know, Nancy drove down from Fort Worth and a couple over here, Jim and Weta, I met in Acapulco not too long ago. You're just at a meeting. You know, you're at a meeting in Acapulco, and kind of a funny story, Jim's at a meeting and he goes over to borrow a tape of another speaker from a woman and doesn't get the other tape, he gets my tape. And he's out of town about 15 miles at a place where very few Americans go, and he's having lunch, and he listened to my tape and he kind of wondered about what I did. He identified a little bit, and all of a sudden an American walks in this very small restaurant and is having trouble ordering, and Jim helps him order. And he asked the stranger where he was from. The stranger said he was from St. Paul, Minnesota. And he said, "Do you know Bob Bazan?" He said, "Oh, hell yes, I jog with him every week." Found out we were in the same business, and he called me the next week to say hello. And life is full of coincidences like that. And I have a lot of friends here, and it's good to see Bill and Arbutus and Jim and Doug and Joe and everybody. So I revel in your love and friendship. And I've enjoyed myself already this weekend. I've met Dupree before, or at least I've seen him before. I've not heard him talk. I enjoyed your talk very much. That's quite a story. And didn't get a chance to hear Beverly. I was going to put a dress on to sneak in the meeting, but I thought I stopped going in drag. Ever since I've been sober, I thought maybe I ought to have a little bit more dignity than that, so I don't do that as much anymore. And I like that Lewis and John did a good job with that big book deal. That was a lot of that going around, and there's some stuff in that book that we could all use a little bit, and I enjoyed that. Donna, I always enjoy listening to you. You've done good. And every weekend there's something, when I go to one of these deals, there's something that kind of touches me, and I think I was most touched by Jason. You know, that was a good, very, that's a hell of a story you got, and I suspect you're going to be doing more of that. So that's kind of neat. Well, about that time, I better start talking a little bit about what it was like and what happened and what it's like today. I'm in Texas, so I also better give my sobriety date. So I don't lose half the audience. Through the grace of God and the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and people like you, I haven't had found an necessary ticket drink since the 10th of December, 1967, and for that I'm very grateful. Well, I took my first drink when I was 14 years old, and it was a real big deal for me. It was a big deal for me because I was an insecure kid. I was, as other people have mentioned, you know, there's a pattern to our stories. We just have this sense of disease and discomfort that we go about trying to fix. I was 4'11". I weighed 95 pounds. I was the second smallest kid in my class. Jason talked about not having body here. I reached puberty when I was married, you know. And there's all sorts of things that you know, I don't know what it is that I remember. Not too long ago, I was in some sort of a workshop about life and looking at something, and a woman said, she said, "You do an awful lot of comparing to other people." And she said, "You don't have to do that." I said, "What in hell would you do if you didn't do that?" I mean, that was, you know, my whole life was kind of comparing myself to other people. I had absolutely no way to look at myself and take any self-satisfaction from who I was. And it became clear to me that the only way I was going to get any respect or kind of be part of was to belong to the group of people who kind of made it happen. No matter where you are, there's always a group of people who make it happen, and I set out to be part of that group of people. And I would do whatever I thought I had to do to be part of that. And so if someone wanted a class clown, I was a class clown. If someone wanted to do someone who would do something daring that no one else would do, I'd do it. And I was good enough at doing that, I guess, that I got to belong to this clique of people who I thought, I'm sure there were other cliques that other people thought were better than that, but I got to be part of this group of people. Except even after I got there, I didn't feel like I belonged. I felt I was there because I was being what they wanted me to be. And if I ever stopped being that, they wouldn't want me anymore. And one night we were out at a party, and a friend of mine had a fifth. We went out, and we flipped that fifth, and I made a discovery. The discovery was, when I put alcohol inside of me, I got a feeling of comfort and well-being, the likes of which I'd never experienced up until the time I took a drink of alcohol. It was just magical. Even after all these years and whatever experience I had with booze, I'm still just absolutely amazed at the transformation that alcohol had in my life. I mean, it just changed everything. It changed my perception. I didn't feel like I was a member of that group that night. I felt like I owned it. It changes it that much. I mean, you literally go around that group and I didn't feel different. I didn't feel smaller. I didn't feel like I didn't belong. I didn't feel like I felt funnier, sexier. You know, we had a lot of doctors and lawyers here this weekend. You know, I'm not a doctor. I'm not. Well, I played doctor. I had pretty good clientele, but I never did get licensed, and I never kind of goofed up my college career, and I never became an attorney, so probably don't have all the qualifications I should have this weekend to talk to you. But alcohol was wonderful. From that moment on, I became a social drinker, and every time anybody else said, I'll have a drink, I just said, so shall I. I just never passed up an opportunity to do it. I did a lot of drinking. From that time on, I got into a lot of trouble. By the time I finished high school, my drinking problem was the largest subject of negative conversation in our home. I went to a high school that was, I think we were trying to play adult. We had fraternities and, you know, we drank a lot. You know, we drank 2-3 nights a week in high school. And I got in some car accidents. I got arrested for false ID cards. I got a lot of my status by my drinking, a lot of attention. If I had a chance to go away to school, and I thought I didn't have a drinking problem. I thought my drinking problem was my family's attitude about my drinking. Because if you got caught when you're underage, it was just forbidden. You know, you got caught by the cops or your father. It never made a difference if you had one drink or 22. You know, you were just drinking and that was wrong. I never wanted to get caught with one drink. That never made sense to me. If I was going to get caught, I was at least going to have had a good time. So I thought that if I would get away and get some place where I could just drink like other people, I wouldn't have a problem, so I went away to school, and that was a big part of how I made that decision. I guess had my drinking normalized, I wouldn't be here this morning. To make a long story short, I drank my way out of the University of Notre Dame in the middle of my senior year. One day I just walked out. And a whole bunch of things have to happen to a young guy who's kind of a status-conscious young guy, you know, to walk out of school in the middle of your senior year. I was down there 3 weeks ago with my 17-year-old. He wanted to see the campus, and he's going to apply. I don't know if he's going to get in. And I noticed that I wasn't on the alumni roll, and that was always kind of I'm in this yearbook, you know, like I graduated, you know, and all that sort of stuff. And I went down and I gave an AA talk there a couple of years ago, and I hadn't been back to that campus since I left. And I remember in the middle of my talk, I was sitting here, and I said, this place has always felt part of a deep sense of failure to me. And I said, I finally figured out why I have that deep sense of failure. And I said, I think it's because I failed. doesn't sound very profound, but it took me 16 years to figure out why I had that sense of failure. So if any of you are looking for deep insights here this morning, you might want to go someplace and get breakfast. But I had started a pattern of behavior that I couldn't stop. I thought that if someone didn't keep the action going during the week, there wouldn't be anything for the weekend for the amateurs to come, you know, participate in. So that was my job. So every time there was a card game going or something going on in town, I had to keep that going. I supported myself by gambling. I made, you know, $4,000 or $5,000 a year gambling, playing pool and playing gin rummy and playing poker, and then I, you know, used that drinking. I never did impress my father. When I walked out, I had a high run of 41 balls in a straight pool, and he never thought that was a very good exchange for the, you know, 10 grand a year he was putting in my college education, but that's about all I walked out of there with. I was due to be commissioned that June as an officer, and I had to get a medical release, so I would have been drafted as a private, and while I was very sick, I was not dumb. The medical release I got was for chronic alcoholism. I was diagnosed an alcoholic when I was 19 years old, and I thought by a psychiatrist who was goofy. It never occurred to me that I could be an alcoholic. I thought that was kind of a joke. Only no one else thought it was a joke. But I left Notre Dame, I came back home, I finished school at a local college, and about the time I finished school, the family asked me to leave home. It had been recommended to them that I be asked to leave home sometime before that, but they were unwilling to do that. And finally they just didn't like the example I was setting, me coming in at 2 or 3 o'clock and some of the fun things we went through with the family, and they asked me to leave, and armed with my college degree and my newfound freedom, I struck out to make my mark in the world, and I took a position as a carryout boy in a liquor store. And I had that job for about 4 or 5 months. I lost it for going 80 miles an hour with a delivery truck. and ended up almost killing a little girl one day backing out of a driveway. She was all right. I came within about 2 inches of doing that. And I ended up taking a job as a waiter at a private club in Minneapolis. I'm living on Skid Row. I'm drinking a quart and a half of booze a day. And it's not working very good. This is kind of the bottom of the trough of my alcoholism. I got up about 10 o'clock in the morning, took a couple of Dexedrine, drank a six-pack of beer, and went to work. I worked from 11 to 2 as a waiter. From 2 to 5, I went and drank beer. And at 5 o'clock, I bought a quart of Southern Comfort and stuck it in my locker. Poured it into a half-pint bottle and sucked on it all night. And then I had to go find a place to live. I didn't have a place that I was staying regularly, so you kind of slept around with different people. That kind of an interesting group of people that you get to meet that way. So at the end of that, we had a guy I worked with. He was a heroin addict, and his wife was a prostitute, and she and I used to share a room. Whenever she had a customer, I used to go out and walk around. When she was done, I got the room. And this was not exactly how I thought it was going to be when I grew up. You know, I mean, I knew it just wasn't exactly how I thought. And I lost that job. I went to a party, and I got beat up so badly. Got kicked in the face, and I couldn't go back to work looking the way I looked. And Dupree talked about going home to mother. That's when I went home to mother. I had no place else to go. I was flat broke. I couldn't work. I lost my job, and I went back, and I asked if I'd come back in the house. And they said yes, but they loved me, and they said I could if I followed certain rules. I'm like a good little drunk. I promised to follow the rules. They let me back in the house. And, you know, alcoholism meant a lot of different things to me, but probably what it meant more than anything else is about every 6 months I had to start my life over. And most of us are starter overs. And we never finish anything. We just constantly start over, and there's a pain connected with that. It's interesting that I think if you had taken my father in one room and asked him to make out a list about what he wanted for me in my life, and put me in a room and asked me to make out a list about what I wanted for me in my life, that those two lists would have been very similar. But if you ever asked my family if they thought what I would have on my list was close to what they had on theirs, they'd say, oh, hell no. Because it looked like I was absolutely hell-bent to destroy my life. I mean, it looked voluntary. It just looked like I was out to destroy everything of any value in my life. At this point in time, I made maybe the largest full-court press of putting my act together that I had ever done. It occurred to me that if I could put certain things into my life, it would order my life and it would be okay. If I could find a woman that I loved, she loved me, and we got married, that would give me some structure, because that's what I needed. I just wasn't a self-starter. I just needed a little structure. If I could get a job that was really a career opportunity rather than this goofing around waiting to see what the service is going to do, that would make a difference. And if I could get out of the house, which was interesting because I was just moving back in the house, that would make a difference. I did not like being the family problem. Okay, I was one of seven kids, wonderful mom and dad, but once or twice a year my dad would be holding my hysterical mother down in a chair, and she'd be, you know, the police would bring me home, or an ambulance would, you know, my brothers would want to kick the hell out of me, and my sisters would be screaming. It'd be one of those nice family get-togethers that you have, you know. And it was, I mean, I can't tell you how many nights I cried myself to sleep listening to my parents argue about what to do with me. I was the family problem at that time. I mean, they were really torn. I mean, they wanted me the hell out of the house and weren't comfortable kicking me the hell out of the house, and it was just a mess. And I started to put these things in my life that would change it. I got back together with a woman that I had gone with for a couple of years, and we'd broken up for almost a year, and we became engaged and married, and today she's my very lovely wife, Linda. I don't often have a place to stick this at the end of my talk, but Linda is an active member of Al-Anon. That's been real important. I know that none of you had any problems in your sobriety, but I continued to have some problems in my sobriety. And, those of us who are in the fellowship think that we are charming and wonderful. There are times when our spouses don't think we're always so charming and wonderful. I think had we not mutually had a program to give us each other some space, I don't think we'd be married today. And so that was real important to me. So I got engaged to Linda. Got a job as an executive trainee in a manufacturing concern. I bought my first automobile, and I thought, hey, it's finally going to happen. And, you know, going to become what I always wanted to be when I grew up, only it didn't happen because I continued to drink and have difficulty. Big corporations are tough places for budding alcoholics. They're kind of rigid. You know, they got rules. They like to have you come in on Mondays. Like to have you stay on Fridays. They got lunch hours. There's a whole bunch of different things that don't work real well. They aren't very flexible. And I'd come in on Mondays, but, you know, not very well. I'd be, you know, someday I'd pull the car over on the freeway thinking I just need 5 more minutes sleep, and some cop would wake me up around 11 o'clock on the freeway, you know. Yeah. I'd crawl into work, or I'd go into work, and my favorite trick was to go into work and get my mail, and I'd take the mail and I'd go in the bathroom, and I'd sit down and I'd fall asleep. And someone would page me, and both my legs would be asleep, and I'd be stumbling down the hall, you know. And look, kind of hard, you know, when you're a classy, up-and-coming young executive, you know, that just doesn't quite give you the image that you want. We finally had a photographer at that company, and he finally took to hiding me in the dark room. I just put a boards up over the developing tanks, and I'd crawl in there and sleep. My hangover was up. And my career wasn't progressing as I thought it should progress. And I had a sense that probably I should look for another opportunity, and I had that job about 6 months, and I left. I took a job selling, which I thought would give me more flexibility. Had that job about 3 weeks, and I went out in a four-day drunk. First 2 days of which I called in, the next 2 days of which I did not call in. And I woke up in an apartment after about a 12-hour blackout, and I didn't know if I had a fiance. I didn't know if I had a place to live until I was married. I didn't know if I had a job, and I was scared. And I didn't feel very good, and all of a sudden the recommendation of my psychiatrist and my father that I look into AA didn't seem so impossible. And I picked up the telephone and I asked the operator for the number of AA, and she gave it to me, and I called. And I got the automobile club. And what I even think is cuter, the lady at the automobile club gave me the number of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I never did find out how that happened, but she did. And I called up and I got the fellow down at central office, and I said, my name is Bob, I think I may have a drinking problem. And he talked to me for about 15, 20 minutes and then called someone else in another line and said, could I meet two fellows at a cafeteria in about a half an hour? And I said that I could. And I got off the line and I called into work and found out I had a job, and I called Linda and found out I had a fiance, and I called home and found out that they were concerned, and concerned is always better than mad. And the blood started to move around. I thought I might live, and I thought, why in hell did you call Alcoholics Anonymous? That's really an overreaction. You're 23 years old. You're not an alcoholic. You always feel guilty when you get up. I mean, that's really kind of silly, you know, that you did that. And I think this is kind of the first example of God's grace operating in my life. Is I thought, it occurred to me that I made a promise to go meet two guys at a cafe, and I thought I ought to go. And I made promises to my parents, to my family, to my school, and here I made a promise to go meet two strangers, and it occurred to me that I better go keep it. And I did. The other reason I went is I wanted to go see what an alcoholic looked like. All minority groups look alike. And I thought that if I could go and see what an alcoholic looked like, I'd come away with a better idea as to why I was not one. You know, if you wanted to sit me down and talk to me about my alcoholism, you had two choices. You also had to be willing to discuss the rottenest thing that I knew about you. Or you had to be willing to wade through as much anger as I could put out. And the idea was, you can come and get me, baby, but it's not going to be for free. And as a result, not too many people had heart-to-heart chats with me about my alcoholism. But these two fellows never gave me a chance to deal with them, because they never talked to me about me, they talked to me about themselves. Sat me down in the booth and told me what their drinking was like, what had happened to them in their lives, how they got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and what was going on today. And I had done an awful lot of 12-step work. You know, I still do a lot of sponsorship. I don't get a chance to do as many first calls as I used to, and I don't know whether I'm slacking off or whether we just have other ways that we're getting people today. I used to make an enormous amount of first calls on people. And for the longest time, I didn't know how to do that very well. I didn't know what my message was, and I was always kind of an intellectual pain in the neck, and I'd talk about the fellowship and the concepts and the steps and all that kind of stuff, and it was a long time before I finally figured out what my message was. The message was my experience, was my story. There's a power in our experience that so far exceeds what we think. When those men sat me down and told me what had happened in their life, I could have gotten up out of that booth and said, I don't want to become a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I could not have gotten up out of that booth without knowing that what had happened to them was true. I mean, they didn't want anything from me. They just sat me down and just shared their life with them. And you just can't blow that away. You can argue with what someone thinks. You can't argue with what they are. And that is what we have for one another that no one else has for us. I'm glad the pre talked about treatment facilities last night. I think we're blessed to have treatment facilities. Those of us who have sat up with drunks at hospitals, shaken and waited the 2 and 3 and 4 hours trying to get them admitted for some other diagnosis, and then they got sober and took off on us, and, you know, we'd have to chase them down the road and all that kind of stuff. We used to carry bottles, and, you know, we said, I wish to hell you could get someone admitted for what's really going on. Now that we can get them admitted for what's really going on, we're mad because someone else is playing with our rubber duck. And, you know, and the fact is that how we receive people today will change. What doesn't change is what we're to do with the person regardless of how they get to us. And our responsibility will always be to share our experience, thanks, and hope with each other and touch each other in a way. And no one else can do that. You just flat, no one else can sit down. This Alcoholics Anonymous was the first place that I ever got to that someone said, you know what's wrong with us? Every place else I've ever been, someone said, you know what's wrong with you? For the first time in my life, I came to you and I was an us. And just that shift gave me an opportunity to learn more about myself than any place I had ever been. And these two men did that well enough. They did it within the scope of their own experience, and honestly, that when they were done, when they asked me if I'd go to a meeting, I said that I would, and I did. The next night, and over the next couple of months, I was allowed the privilege to make a couple of discoveries of her to change my life. And before I share those discoveries with you, I want to share with you the attitude I walked into the front door with. And I share that with you because it's an attitude that recurs in my life today. And it's an attitude that's relatively important to my story. I used to get asked all the questions that alcoholics get asked by people who love them and are baffled by what the hell they're doing with their lives. I used to get asked questions like, Bob, why do you drink the way you drink? And I never had a very good answer for that. But my thinking kind of went, I drink because I have problems. I don't have problems because I drink. If you know how many times I started out to have it be okay, if you know how many times I'd go for what I really wanted in life and the wheels just came off it. I mean, if I could just pick my batting average of about 15 points, I wouldn't have a problem. I mean, I drink because I got these problems. And pretty soon the problems are going to go away and I'm not going to have a drinking problem, so why don't we just kind of talk about something else? I was lodged between a sister who did graduate work at the Sorbonne and a brother who was Phi Beta Kappa in law school, and when you're lodged between two show-offs like that, you don't look so good. And I think the only reason my brother went to law school is made me look bad. I don't think he likes being a lawyer. You know, I mean, most lawyers I know aren't happy. You know, I mean, I just think he did it. Just one more competitive thing that he did. He was always making me look bad. I mean, he went to Notre Dame and graduated magna cum laude. I mean, he didn't have to do that. He could have just kind of slowed it down a little bit, you know, so. I used to get questions like, Bob, wouldn't you like to be like someone else? And I'd say, yeah, I'd like to be like someone else. How do you do it? Where are the directions? I mean, as bad as this is all I've got. I don't have any other way to do it. I don't like that any better than you like it. I really don't have any other way of doing this. I'm doing the very best I know how to do. So I heard this next statement was, I heard it hundreds of times in a relatively short drinking period. I said, Bob's a hell of a guy if he just wouldn't drink. And I got the very clear message that what was wrong with me was swallowing bourbon. If I ever stopped swallowing bourbon, my life would be okay. Well, like a lot of us, I had chances not to drink. Just before I went back to my senior year at school, I had one of those, biannually or 2 or 3 times a year kinds of deals where I ran into a bad batch of ice and it kind of threw my timing off, and I was beaten up, robbed, rolled, pistol whipped, and I was shot at, and I was thrown out of the second story of a hotel, and I ended up in a state of shock in an alley and got taken to a hospital. I'm in a hospital, I'm waiting for the doctor to come patch me. A regular doctor doesn't come, my psychiatrist comes. They were going to put me in a psych ward and observe me. They weren't going to let me go back to school, and if any of you enjoying my talk here this morning, you should have heard the one I gave 22 years ago to get out of the psych ward at Miller Hospital. It was one of the better talks under stress I've ever given. And they let me out of that hospital and they go back to school in the condition that I wouldn't drink, and I went back and I didn't drink for about 3 months. And my life didn't instantaneously get better. I didn't all of a sudden become what you were telling me I'd become if I just wouldn't drink. I didn't become an A student, I didn't become a model Christian, didn't become a perfect son. I got so I liked you assuming that I'd be gangbusters if I didn't drink. It got, that was how I lived my life. I got so I was frightened that if I ever did sober up, I'd have to be something I couldn't be. That was as scary to me when I went to sober up as the problems that I was having when I was drinking. Okay, so I learned two things when I quit drinking for those 3 months. Is number one, I quit drinking anytime I wanted to. And number two, that what was wrong with me wasn't drinking because I just quit and my problems didn't go away. Alcohol was my answer, it was not my problem. It caused me difficulty, but by and large, it worked as well as anything I had in my life. I knew where to get it, what it would do, and how much of it to take. And it was wonderful. It really made it tolerable. Without alcohol, I really don't know what I would have done with the problems I was having in my life. Booze made the noise go away. It really made it okay. The last thing the people used to say to me is they'd say, Bob, I think you're an alcoholic. And I'd say, well, I can see with the information you have about me why you think I'm an alcoholic. But there's a lot of information about me you don't have. There's a lot of things about me you don't know. There's problems I've had before I ever took a drink of alcohol. There's hang-ups I got. There's problems I've had cold, stone sober, thinking and behavior that have nothing to do with swallowing bourbon. And I think if you knew about all those dark crevices of my life, you wouldn't think I was just an alcoholic. So thanks a lot for your concern. Why don't you just get off my back? Now that, to the best of my recollection, was how I presented myself to you. I was 23 years old. I didn't know whether to call you by your first names or your last names. I thought you were going to give me a test. I guess that was my student background. I thought you were going to ask me why I was there. And I showed up and on a Thursday night in July of 1967, I drank twice after walking in the front door of Alcoholics Anonymous. And once after about 6 to 8 weeks, I'm going to have to get catheterized, buddy, if I drink all those. So. Thank you. Once after about 6 or 8 weeks of sobriety, I was on a business trip to the West Coast, and they told me the minute I got off the plane to call Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't. I stayed sober for the first week and drank for the second and got into some trouble out there. And then I was sober for almost 3 months, and I got married, and I went on our honeymoon. And we honeymooned in Acapulco, and you know where the divers dive off those cliffs? And I drove off those cliffs on my last truck. I was in the audience watching a world high diving contest, and with the ex-president of Mexico and a whole bunch of people, and after about 9 planners' punches, that doesn't look so tough. And the original ugly American routine, you know, I went down there and I split my swimsuit and cut my knee and cut my elbow, and my wife's trying to bribe people to get me down off the mountain. It was not classy. I mean, in your mind, you can picture this and say, wow, but I'm telling you, if you were there, it wasn't classy. And I got up to a height of about 100, no, not 100, got up to a height of about 85 feet. The divers died from about 110, and I got stuck, couldn't get up, couldn't get down, and God watch it after fools and drunks, because I dove, and, you know, here I am. And the last drink I had was on the airplane on the way home. But I was allowed the privilege to make 2 discoveries when I came to you, which were to change my life. I made them over a couple of month period of time. First was that alcoholism was a disease. You say, well, gosh, everybody knows alcoholism is a disease. Well, I didn't. I thought alcoholism was something that happened to you when you were a whole lot older and a lot sloppier and you had problems functioning because you were just physically drunk all the time. That didn't seem to describe me. It described me fairly well, but it didn't seem to describe me. But you tell me that alcoholism was a disease that affected me as a total person, mentally, physically, and spiritually. And once I crossed the line from problem drinking into alcoholism, my alcoholism affected me all the time, when I was drinking and when I was not drinking. And I can't tell you how important it was for me to find out that there was a mental or psychological or emotional aspect to alcoholism, because I just had the damnedest time connecting all the chaos in my life with drinking bourbon. I mean, I just knew that wasn't going to be the answer to my problem, and you told me, of course, it wasn't. You told me that the physical part of alcoholism was 10 or 15% of my problem, that drinking was a symptom of the disease of alcoholism. I remember one old timer said to me, he said, Bob, you don't have a drinking problem. And I said, could you put that in writing? Yeah. And he said, no, smart aleck. He said, you got a drinking problem. But he said, if all you had was a drinking problem, all you'd have to do is quit. He said, have you ever quit? And I said, yeah, I've quit. He said, how did it work? I said, it didn't work real good. He said, I didn't think so. Because what's wrong with us is alcoholism. The symptom of alcoholism is drinking. But we do what Alcoholics Anonymous do with alcoholism is once we take our last drink of alcohol, we use the 12 recovery steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to treat our spiritual and mental aspects of the disease to find a different way to live. And if you don't find another way to live, you're going to go back to drinking because you don't know how to live without drinking. I don't think I've ever been told a truer thing than that. I mean, it just flat did not know how to live without drinking. Drinking made living tolerable. And when I was sober, I was just waiting to get drunk again. I mean, it just didn't work. It was just, I was clumsy and awkward and nothing worked. The other discovery I made is that there was a lot of people in those rooms and drunk an awful lot of booze. Now they weren't doing it. The only observable reason for them not drinking is they liked what they found in sobriety better than what they found in a bottle. And that intrigued me because by this time I guess I knew I might have to quit, but God, I thought my life was over. I had so much of my identity tied up in being cool and tied up in people who drink. I didn't hang around with anybody who didn't drink, and I just saw this great big hole in my life. But I sat in meetings and I listened to you talk about, you were out there chasing it pretty good. You were out there chasing those bright lights, and it just got too tough, and for whatever reason you came into the fellowship and now you weren't doing it, and clearly your lives were not over. Clearly they were not over. There was a joy and a sense of liveliness and a sense of happiness and a sparkle in your eye, and I wanted to find out what that was, and I'm glad I had the opportunity to find it out. I view my sobriety as a gift. An awful lot of the 12-step work that I did when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous was with young people. You know, I was the youngest person in our group for 2 years, and we always make the mistakes in our fellowship. We are just goofy with all the experience we have. When we get a celebrity, we have a celebrity calling a celebrity. You know, we got a doctor, we want someone who's the biggest deal in town to call in the doctor, you know. And they used to have me calling all the young people. And I think that was a mistake. I'm just privileged to have had the relationships I had with my sponsor, who now has 34 years of sobriety. And I'm glad that those were the people who called on me, that those were the people that I developed a relationship with, those were the people I needed them. But I called on literally hundreds of people my age, and I ran into people who were brighter. I ran into people who needed it more. I ran into people who had lost more than I had lost, and they weren't allowed to stay. And I got clearly that my sobriety was a gift. My sobriety did not have to do with me being smart. It did not have to do with me being better. It did not have to do with me needing it more. It did not have to do with me having lost more or less than someone else lost. It had to do with it being a gift. And so, to that extent, I always feel privileged to have the opportunity to somehow put back in the pot a little bit about what I've taken out. And I've taken out, it feels at times like I've taken out my share and a couple of other people's share. And kind of crude, buddy, but that's all right. I started a process in recovery that was as exciting as my, you know, as much as alcoholism is a disease process and it's progressive, recovery is a process and it's progressive and it gets better. And recovery was an awful lot different than I really thought it would be. And I'm kind of glad, because had I dictated my own recovery, I would have missed an awful lot of things. I would have left out a lot of things that I didn't know to put in, and I would have missed a lot of things that were essential to it. The most important early event in my recovery had to do with tearing down my wall. The first thing drinking robbed me, I was a little bit extra that it took to be a success at anything that I did. Kind of took the hop off my fastball. The next thing it did is it started to eat into areas of responsibility, and I kind of instinctively did what we do. I started to lie and cover up, and I started to build a wall between you and me. And I built that wall up so that you couldn't see the chaos and the unmanageability in my life, and brick by brick I built a wall up. And the thinking that went on behind the wall was something like this. It said, you like me, but you only like what I let you see about me. Because if you could see everything about me, all the dark, dirty, lousy, unattractive, insufficient things about Bob Bazan, you'd hate my guts because I hate my guts. And who knows more what a lousy person I am than me. I was walking around comparing my insides with your outsides. And the only way to come out doing that is second best. But at some point in time behind that wall, I got sick enough, tired enough, afraid enough, and just gave up. And it started when I picked up the telephone to call Alcoholics Anonymous and entered in my fifth step, but I tore that wall down and I said, hey, come and get me. I don't care who you are or where you come from, but just come and get me and help me not be who I am anymore. I can't stand it one more minute. And for the first time in my life, I shared the whole deck of cards with someone. Jason said last night, we're only as sick as we are secretive. Up until that time, I had never shared the whole deck of cards with someone. My family had part of it. My spouse had part of it. My coworkers had part of it. My friends had part of it, but no one had all of it. And I would kill you with the piece you didn't have. And if we do anything daily in this program today, we kill each other with the pieces of our lives that we will not entrust with anybody in the program. People would come to me and they say, Bob, I think you ought to do this. And in my mind, I'd go to them with a problem. I'd sit down and I'd talk to them with a problem. And they'd help me with the problem. But if I didn't like the solution, I'd say, well, you don't know this and this and this about me. I'd say that privately. And I'd neutralize whatever they told me because I was unique. I was almost criminally unique in that process. No one knew who I was. And as a result, I was absolutely autonomous. I could neutralize anybody who tried to help me in my life, and I was absolutely alone. The only thing an alcoholic can do while alone is die, get sick. Only thing we can do alone. But when I tore that wall down and let it all go on, for the first time in my life, I shared the whole deck of cards with someone, and shared all the things that separated me and made me a moral leper. I made a discovery, and the discovery was that I'm not unique. My personality may be unique, but not my illness, not my experience, not my feelings. And for the first time in my life, I started to have a ray of hope that maybe a solution that wasn't unique could operate in my life. I told you that I've always been a person who started over. I've always been a person who looked pretty good in the process of starting over. I was a person who if we had a race, we were going to run a 100-yard race, okay? I'd have the hell of a pair of tennis shoes. I'd have cute little shorts. I'd have a nice little top. And I really looked like I was going to do a good job. I kind of look athletic, and, you'd think that if we were all out there with a group of 50 or 60 of us, that I was going to be one of the people who had a pretty good shot at winning that race. And I'd sure talk like I had a pretty good shot at winning that race. Now, what would happen is I wouldn't finish that race. But I would have a story to tell you about not finishing that race that would be very effective. And you would believe that story because I looked as if there was absolutely no observable reason, and actually for the first 30 or 40 yards of the race, I was up in front. And so when I told you the story about my bad leg, or, I've had cramps and I had diarrhea yesterday and I've just been a little bit off my feet, or whatever story I told you, it just seemed believable, because why the hell else would a person who was doing pretty well the first 30 or 40 yards, who dressed as well as I dressed and seemingly had as much experience and ability as I had, why else would you not finish? Because that's just what I did with my life. I just not finished everything in my life. And it got so, I was so used to that eventually I wouldn't even try. I'd just make up a story about why I wasn't doing it. And as long as I had an explanation for why I wasn't doing it, it was just fine with me. I didn't even try. A lot of pain in life when you live your life that way. That's how I live my life. I live my life in failure, never having the opportunity of success. Never occurred to me to take the risk. By random chance, I could have had a better result than I was having in most areas of my life. But I lived in failure and told a story that I thought worked about why I was there. But I had an explanation, and as long as I had an explanation, that was okay. I was afraid that Alcoholics Anonymous was going to be one more thing that I was leaving in the first 30 or 40 yards, that I had all these older people who were telling me how well I was doing, but they never knew that I didn't finish anything. And I was afraid that I wasn't going to finish, because I had lived in a family that worked for everybody else and didn't seemingly work for me. I was in a faith that was seemingly important and worked for other people and didn't seem to work for me. I went to schools that worked for other people and didn't work for me. And one more time, I had absolutely no argument with the program or the people, and I was just afraid that there's going to be one more place that I was going to come that worked for other people but didn't work for me, because you see, I'm different. I don't want to be different. I'm kind of like you. I have an awful lot of similarities with you, and we talk about a lot of things that we have in common at meetings, but really I'm different. I'm just a little different. That'll kill us. That really flat will kill us. And if it doesn't kill us, it will diminish the level of enjoyment of our sobriety to a point of it just being tolerable. We will live our life in sobriety at a level of resignation. I'm going to talk a little bit about that in a few minutes, but we will live our sobriety in resignation. It's unnecessary that we live our sobriety in resignation. But when I tore that wall down and I shared my life with you, and you told me that you understood, I started to have a feeling that you really did understand. You also told me that you loved me, and for the first time in my life, I felt love. Because you knew all the things about me that I wouldn't ever tell anybody. I was surrounded by love all my life, but I never felt love. Because I thought they loved me because they didn't know me. And I came to you, and it was necessary for me to have you know me. And I let you know me, and you told me you loved me, and I felt love. You actually taught me the experience of experiencing love, and now I can experience it even from people who don't understand me. And in that way, I can experience the love of my parents through you. I just flat couldn't experience it the other way. But I had to get rid of enough of my uniqueness and feel part of you to really have a sense of confidence and opportunity that the steps were going to work in my life, because if I was really, truly that unique, it would work for you, but it wouldn't work for me. But if I was part of you, if I had what you had, then what worked in your life could work in mine. And I started to have a level of hope that transformed my life. And I started to walk in recovery. You know, drunks are truly tough people. I tell a story that I think describes alcoholics. We don't have many definitions of alcoholics and drug addicts in our literature. In all our literature, I think we only have two or three. We have one description in the big book, and we have a couple of definitions of alcoholism and some pamphlets that we have that we borrowed from other people. And it's amazing how little descriptive that we do about the disease. Of course, we concentrate on the solution, so we don't have to describe the disease that much. But the one I like the best is the description of an alcoholic and a normal person. You put them in a room, and over here you have a door, and out that door is a person with a baseball bat, that if you walk out the door, they'll hit you over the head with a baseball bat. And over here is a door that if you go out the door, there's happiness forever after. Now, a normal person will get up and go over to that door and open it up and get hit on top of the head and get knocked down and come back in. And then they will go over to that door, and they will open it up, and they will have happiness forever after. An alcoholic will go over to that door, open it up, get hit on top of the head, and get knocked down and come back in. And then they will get up and go over to that door, and they will open it up and get hit on top of the head and get knocked down and come back in. And they'll get up and they'll go over to that door, and they get hit on top of the head, and they get knocked down, and they'll come back in. And they'll get up and they'll go over to that door and get hit on top of the head. And one day they will go to that door, and the person with the bat will not be there, and they will go looking for him. We really are like that. I was like that in the way that I came in, and very early on in my program, I made enormous progress early on. Well, I'm going to go into my disclaimer for a moment because I'm going to launch for the next, I'm going to close in about 15 minutes. And I'm going to talk about some problems that I've had in sobriety. And it's going to sound like my sobriety was not enjoyable. Now, remember when you get people up here and they take their one-year pin and they thank you or chip and they tell you how wonderful the year has been? And when they take the two-year chip, they tell you how great it's been and how sick they were 1 year, but now, you know, this last year has really made a difference. And when they take their five-year pin, they tell you how sick they've been all the previous 5 years, but now that it's okay. When I was experiencing my sobriety, it was wonderful. It was ever so much better than what I had before I came to you. And I look back on my sobriety with eyes of someone who's been sober a little over 18 years, and I am a critic of that in some ways. I don't want to give you the impression that my early sobriety was horrible. It was not horrible. It was great. But I have some insights about that process that I didn't have going through it. I'm going to share some of those insights with you. The timing of the happenings of those experiences are absolutely unimportant. Some of the things that happened to me at 10 years will happen to you at 2. But it is my experience and my opinion that some of the process of what I went through is not an unfamiliar process. That it is a process that many of us will have an opportunity to see it. And that's why I share it. You remember when I tore that wall down and I shared my life with you? Well, I started to have in sobriety problems that I didn't think I should have in sobriety. And when I had those problems that I didn't think I should have, I did what I always did. I lied and covered up. I didn't want to disappoint you. You know, I'd have my checking account be $500 overdrawn. I'd be at a meeting, and when we went out to dinner, I'd buy. I, of course, didn't want you to think things weren't going well. I had a series of problems in my life that were horrible, and they were ordinary, and they were eating my lunch. They were problems that I had before I came to you, and they were problems that I had in my first year of sobriety, only I never noticed I had it in my first year of sobriety. God, my first year of sobriety was just like a flat honeymoon. But the problems I had were these. They were that I couldn't get up in the morning. I set the alarm clock for 7, and I'd get up at 8:30, and I'd go to work at 9:15. And then I'd play around at work for a while, and I'd go out for a 2.5-hour AA lunch, because any time, anywhere, the hand of AA reached out, you were supposed to be there. And then I'd go down to the club, and I'd play backgammon. I gambled a little bit. It wasn't serious. It was more like a hobby. It was, you know, 3 to 5 days a week, 4 to 5 hours a day. It was nothing. I mean, it was just more or less something that I... But I made $5,000 to $10,000 a year doing it, and I thought I needed the money. Okay? But this time I'm married, and I have 2 children. I now have 3 boys. But I had 2 boys, and I was scared to death about being a parent. It still is the most challenging area of my life. And I was angry, and I was impatient, and I was loud, and it's not a very good combination to be a parent. And that was a problem for me. I had a problem with my wife. My wife was, you know, 22, 23 years old, and thought she was going to spend the rest of her life in an AA meeting. You know, she wondered if she was going to have any life outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was at meetings 6 and 7 nights a week, and she was complaining about it. I thought, my God, you ought to be grateful. I'm sober. And go look around. I mean, you go to these Al-Anon meetings. I mean, why would you? I mean, you know, how ungrateful you are. I mean, you know, aren't you supposed to take your own inventory? And, you know, we'd go a few rounds about that. And I had a money spending problem. I spent $200 to $500 more a month than I made. And if you do that over a long period of time, you'll end up in debt. I just want to report that to you. You may not have to run that process all the way out. You may just want to take someone's word for it, but most of us don't. So I just want to let you know that if you spend $200 to $500 more a month than you make over a long period of time, you'll end up in debt. And I had these problems not sometimes. I had them all the time. I had them daily. And I commenced the first year, had them, didn't notice. Second, third year, started to have a program, started to have a sense of what a program was, didn't even really know. Started to have a sense of having a personal opportunity to participate in the steps. And I started to apply these steps to what was going on in my life. And the second and third year, I started to have some discomfort about what the content of my life was. Now, one of the things they don't tell you when you sober up is what happens is they change your value system and they change your level of honesty. And things that I never even noticed in my first year of sobriety started to bother me in my second and third, and started to eat my lunch in my fourth and fifth year of sobriety, and damn near killed me in my sixth and seventh year of sobriety. Because I couldn't stuff and deny them later in my sobriety. I just knew too much. Okay, and that's the process that started to happen to me. And I tried to deal with these things, and I failed. I didn't fail sometimes. I failed all the time. Okay, this was a daily part of my life. Okay. Now, as I told you, I was a pretty active member of AA, did a lot of 12-step work. And my life was dealing with these issues unsuccessfully. And I used to get, you know, a new guy come into the club, and he'd share with me this bushel basket full of cancer that we all walk in with, and he'd tell me about the spouse, and he'd tell me about the job, and he'd tell me about his money, and he'd tell me about the police, and he'd tell me about all these problems he had. And I'd sit him down, and I'd give him a cup of coffee, and we'd talk about it, and I'd say, hey, as bad as it is, and as hopeless as it seems, it's going to be okay. I know you don't know how it's going to happen. I know you don't believe me, but if you come in and just do the things that we do, it's going to work. And I believed that for him, but then I'd get in the car and I'd drive home and I'd say, Bob, when's it going to work for you? You've been sober 6 years, Bob. When are you going to stop being a big shot? You just bought a $400 suit today, Bob, and you already had an account down there and you haven't paid your bill in 4 or 5 months. When's it going to work for you? When are you going to stop being so angry with your kids? When are you going to be a good husband? When are you going to learn how to work? When's it going to be okay, Bob? I mean, clearly it was not okay. And I was working as hard as I knew how to work at it, and it was not getting better. Now, I knew what the answer was. I flat know what the answer was. The answer was they have a relationship with a God you're very ununderstanding. But there's a problem with that. And the problem is, you know, we all know what's going to happen when you go talk to God. So I knock on the door, and God says, who's there? And you say, Bob. What do you want? I said, I want a relationship. He said, I've been working on it as hard as I know how to work on it. I've been used the program as a higher power, used my sponsor as a higher power, used the group as a higher power. And I just tapped out, baby. Here I am. I want to take a look at my life. Okay? And from what I can see, the people who really have the kind of life that I want, that have peace in their life, have a relationship with you. I'd like a relationship with you. So I'm here to turn myself in, and I'm willing to do what you want me to do. What would you like me to do, God? The guy said, well, the first thing I'd like you to do, but I'd like you to stop gambling. I'd like you to stop, change your reading material a little bit. I'd like you to stop hitting your kids. I'd like you to be a good husband. Okay? I'd like you to go to work at 8 o'clock in the morning and get done at 5, and don't spend any more money than you make. Well, hell, I mean, if I could do that, I wouldn't need him. That's what I've been trying to do for 7 years. Okay? That's the very first thing he's going to say to me when I go ask him for a relationship. He's going to ask me to clean my act up. Well, I can't clean my act up. I mean, I flat can't clean my act up. It isn't as if, I mean, I can't clean my act up. That is a rock and a hard place. That, I think, is the opportunity in the middle years of sobriety. Okay. When I came to you, I gave you my alcoholism. I gave you everything directly related to my alcoholism. I put it in your hands and never took another drink. I didn't give you my life. I didn't give you my job. I didn't give you my sex life. I didn't give you my money. I didn't give you my gambling. I didn't give you my kids. I didn't give you my wife. Didn't know I had to. Had a drinking problem. I came to you and asked for help with my drinking problem, and you surrendered it to you, and you took it, and I never had a drinking problem again. But I had these other things, and they were killing me. I did the only thing I knew how to do. I went back to the steps. I took step one, sober 6 or 7 years. I found out what unmanageability and powerlessness meant to me 6 or 7 years. I came to the second step, that said God would restore me to sanity, came to believe. I've always believed that step corporately. I've always believed it for us. I have had absolutely no question that God would restore us to sanity, and I've never believed it for me. I never believed that God would restore Bob Bazan's to sanity, and I had to come to believe that God would restore Bob Bazan's to sanity, not us to sanity. I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to care of God on my knees in my sponsor's office. It was embarrassing for both of us. I mean, I didn't want to do that. It seemed silly. It seemed dramatic. It seemed a lot of different things, but I never noticed that particularly before in the book, and I didn't want to. I wanted to have my life change. Okay, and I did that. Today, step three for me isn't a step that I take. It's simply a recognition of a fact. My life is right now, has always been, and will always be in the care of God as I understand Him. I'm an ant on a log going down a river. It looks as if I'm steering the log when it goes around the bend, but I am not. I can position myself on the log, but I am not steering the log. When I am in tune with the world like that, when I realize my position, I have more peace in the matter than when I think I'm steering the log. I took an inventory. I went to one of my sponsors, and I took a fifth step with my sponsor, and I let it all go. And I said, Tom, when I'm done with this, I said, be careful because I'm going to do whatever you tell me. I said, I know in the deep recesses of my heart, there's just, I'm surrounded by too much power. There's just too much power available to me in this program for it to be necessary to me to have this level of unmanageability. And I said, and I can't do a damn thing about it. But I'm willing to do whatever I got to do to clean it up. And I mean whatever I got to do. Took a fifth step, we cried a little bit, and one of the things you recommended that I go to an industrial psychologist is a guy who his company spent some time with, and I can't tell you how much I didn't want to do that, and I did it. And in the process of doing that, I got in touch with some stuff that I was able to bring back into my program. I got in touch with how afraid I was of failure. I was just, you know, I remember the psychiatrist asked me, he said, what are you so afraid of? And I said, I'm afraid of failing. He said, what happens to you when you fail? I said, what do you mean, what happens to you when you fail, bozo? Don't you work with people? Don't you know what failure is? I mean, and he said, yeah, I know what failure is. He said, well, what happens to you? And I said, well, you lose everything you have. What the hell do you think happens to you? File bankruptcy, everybody thinks you're an ass. You know, they publish your name in the paper, and he goes through, and he says, who's going to be with you when that happens? I said, you lose everything you got. And he looked over at my wife, and he said, are you going to be there? She said, yeah, I'll be there. Now, all of a sudden, it became clear to me that what I really was afraid of is, you know, the ego factors in that. I mean, I was going to have my wife. I was going to have my parents. I was going to have my kids. I was going to have you. Okay? But I wasn't going to have my image. And all of a sudden, I gave myself the freedom to fail. That wasn't the result I got, but I gave myself the freedom to fail, and in giving myself the freedom to fail, I became a player. I went over to the locker room, and I got a helmet, and I became a player. Now, the funny part of it is an awful lot of us were afraid of being players, and we think we're on the bench watching the game. And what we don't realize is that in life, there's no bench. It's just all field. And I was like in the middle of the field without a helmet, without any pads on. Every time anybody wanted, they just go by and hit me. I was wondering why I had all these damn bruises because I wasn't even in the game. I thought I was in the stand. And it just so happens that we're all in the game. There is no place to hide in life. And I thought I was in the stands, waiting for the right opportunity to enter the game. Not so. Not so. I started to make some changes in my life. I took that fifth step, and one day I was at home and I was doing some spiritual reading, non-conference approved kind of stuff. And I'd had a terrible day, but one of those days where I'd done a whole bunch of things I didn't want to do and I'd not done a whole bunch of things that I wanted to do. And I realized that I had tried as hard as I knew how to try to clean my act up, and I'd failed. And all of a sudden I saw that I was exactly where I was supposed to be, and I was given the opportunity to take the sixth and the seventh steps of AA. The sixth step said that we were entirely ready to have God remove our defects of character, and the seventh step said that we humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. I have been trying for 7 years to get rid of my defects of character. I submit to us that you go about the process of getting rid of your defects of character differently than you go about the process of getting entirely ready to have God remove them. It was like, you know, I remember sitting in the chair that day, and I spent the whole afternoon down at the club gambling. I think I won $300-$400. I was feeling so bad. I mean, I had some stuff I was supposed to do at work, and I hadn't done it. And my wife was mad at me, and I'm depressed, and I'm in the chair. And I don't want, you know, the kids are in the room trying to be quiet because they don't want to, you know, disturb the ogre and all that kind of stuff. And I'm really, you know, and I say, gee, it happened again. And I say, what do you mean it happened again? Weren't you there? And I say, well, yeah, I was there, but I mean, you know, this stuff is so habitual. But I mean, it just kind of, I just go on automatic pilot, and I just kind of wake up afterwards, and there I was. And all of a sudden, I realized that that was absolutely baloney. That there was a lot of habit involved, not much decision, but I was making a decision to live my life the way I was. Time after time after time, and as a result of making those decisions, I had this mess. Where I wanted to go was over here, and what I had to do to get over here was let go of this mess. And the fact of the matter is that I talked a pretty good game. I talked like I wanted to get rid of my gambling, but I didn't, because I liked the results of it. I talked like I wanted to spend more time with my kids, but I didn't. I talked like I wanted to spend more time with my wife, but I didn't. I wanted to be out there where the action was. I had her light, love, and affection. It was yours that I wanted. Okay? So I had this game going on. And I had to really be honest enough to realize that this was what I wanted, baby. I had exactly what I wanted. Isn't it funny? At the end of, I had exactly what I wanted. I talked as if it wasn't. I didn't want to work 8 hours. Who the hell wants to work 8 hours? Normal people work 8 hours. I'm not normal. Who the hell wants to get up and go to work at 8 o'clock and come home at 5? You know. I've never wanted that. You know, and I had to get honest with myself and realize that I had exactly what I wanted. And it was killing me. It was killing me. And all of a sudden, out of fear, I became entirely ready to have God remove my defects of character. And I got down on my knees and I asked Him to. And that day, four of the major problems I was dealing with in my life disappeared. Such is the power of our program. Now, I had to cooperate with them. I had to hire someone to wake me up. I found out that I'd get up for you, but I wouldn't get up for me. Okay, I didn't miss planes. I didn't miss hunting trips. I didn't miss appointments. But I missed getting up for me. So I found someone who was important enough in my life and had them call me at an appropriate time when I got up for them. I gave my wife the finances. I found out that my wife knew how to pay a third of a bill. Damnedest thing I've ever seen. She could take a bill and break it up into three parts and pay it. It's just, I never knew that that was possible. I didn't want people to think I didn't have the money, so I'd kind of wait. If you got mad at me, I wouldn't put your name in the hat. And I made appointments with my psychologist about when I'd go to work and when I'd leave, when I'd gamble, when I wouldn't gamble. And so I did a lot of things to support what I was doing. I started to date my wife every Friday night for the last 11 or 12 years. I date my wife every Friday night. When I'm gone on a trip like this, I change the day. Put her in a fancy dress, take her out to dinner, and those early days, we just went to a Mexican restaurant, and she had a couple of drinks, we went to a movie. You know, now money's a little bit different. You know, sometimes it's a little bit fancier than that, but the idea was, I didn't want to spend time with my wife alone. I wanted to be with you. And now, I'd rather be with my wife than I would be with anybody else. And I started to change a little bit at a time. But you know how we change an alcoholic anonymous? A doctor doesn't heal. A doctor creates an aseptic environment, creates an atmosphere in which healing can take place, and God heals. And a farmer doesn't grow. A farmer creates a fertile soil, creates an environment in which growth can take place, plants a seed, and God grows, and we don't change. We create an atmosphere in which change can take place, and God changes us, and the atmosphere is that of being honest, open-minded, and being willing. The attitude involved in the sixth and the seventh step of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. We are living, many of us in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous are living our lives in resignation. We're doing what I did when I came in. We gave our drinking problems to the program, and the program dealt with them, because the program's got an enormous amount of power. And we hung on to a bunch of different living problems that we had because we didn't know enough to put them in. It isn't as if we're bad people. But our own self-management on these things doesn't work. If we had the ability to deal with our defects of character, we wouldn't need these damn meetings. We would not need these meetings. I mean, I sat out there on the front row of those things year after year after year, killing myself with my gambling problems and all this other stuff. And I'm not telling you like I got it all dealt with today. I got plenty of problems in front of me today. I've got a 17-year-old, a 14-year-old, and a 5-year-old. Okay, I've got a company with 350 employees. There's a lot of different things. I'm in the game today. I'm a player today. And I sure don't own it, but I rent it more regularly than I ever have. I'm in love with my wife today. I'm a better parent today than I ever have been. I'm self-supporting through my own contributions. I'm in the game today. Okay? And I'm regularly a horse's ass. Regularly. Okay? But I no longer have any doubt whether or not the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has the power to deal with my life. Okay? Now, we sit out there in resignation with the problems we have in our life. You heard Dupree talk? He's one of three people that walked out of Lexington as an addict at his time and got sober. You think there's power in this program? Okay. You heard Jason talk? You heard what happened to Jason's life? You think there's power in this program? Now, you think if the program has that kind of power, to take a drug addict and restore him, you know, to do what it did with Jason, do you think it would work on marriages? On gambling problems, and work problems, and finances. Do you think it would work? Yeah, it sure as hell would. And we're settling for that lie that we told ourselves when we came in. People said to you, no, it's wrong with you, you got a drinking problem. We knew we didn't have a drinking problem. We knew in the recesses of our heart that was wrong with us was that drinking was a symptom, that there was something wrong with us that was deeper and dirtier and stronger and different. And it was alcoholism. The symptom of alcoholism was a drinking problem. The problem with all of us is we're working on a damn symptom. We're working on the end of the pipe that the water's coming out. trying to put her hand up against the end of the pipe, and the water's playing all over the place, and we're dealing with the results. A money problem that doesn't do with money. I had a money problem when I made 15 grand a year, and a money problem when I made 40. And sex problem doesn't have to do with sex. If we would, the power in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is not knowledge. Power in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is surrender. We had a problem in our lives that tore our lives apart daily, destroyed our lives. People would give us information and it had no effect whatsoever. People would punish us, people would force us, people would tell us, people would help us, and it had absolutely no impact on our lives at all. And one day, we surrendered. And we never again had a problem with alcohol. I mean, that was never again. Not bad. Not bad. And we're walking around with problems, and the reason we got the problems is because we got the problem. Surrender is the power of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The reason that the program is not working on the problems in my life is I have not surrendered the problem to the program and to the power. I don't have the power. Last night when we read chapter 5, it said our description of the alcoholic, chapter 2, the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. That A, we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. And that B, probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And that C, God could and would if he were sought. Question I asked myself in my living room 12 years ago was, Bob, how much time have you spent seeking God? Thank you.